At the regular Emergency Operations Center update yesterday, Mike Twenge announced that the community would be moving to red status following recent hospitalizations and one death.
We have recently increased our active case count to 157. If this number is any indicator, this could produce 200 more cases within the next 2 weeks. We, as a community, working together, need to avoid this rapid rise. Kodiak Providence Hospital is in red status. They have admitted 12 COVID patients since Thanksgiving. Today, there are two hospitalizations remaining. One patient was recently medevaced to Anchorage for higher level of care. Kodiak Emergency Medical Service continues to respond and transport positive COVID patients daily.
During his address, Twenge announced further steps to curb the intense spread of COVID-19 in Kodiak.
Today, the Emergency Services Council is moving the community mitigation plan to reflect the pandemic risk level 5, red risk level. This status puts Kodiak at a reduced occupancy capacity. In-person shopping, dining, drinking, bowling, theater, and use of the public library are now restricted. Basically, every business and public facility are now going to follow their mitigation red risk level in addition to the requirements announced today by the ESC.
These changes will not go into effect immediately, but instead will begin this Monday, the 7th of December.
So here we go. Effective 8 a.m. December 7th, next Monday, through December 21st of this year, all Kodiak Island businesses and activities, including all retail and service types, indoor recreational activities, bars, restaurants, religious gatherings, grocery, and any business or service that is open to the public, is now restricted to 25% customer capacity. This capacity is calculated from the business fire marshal occupancy load.
And here is today's Kodiak Emergency Operations Center update. 23 new cases have been reported for the Kodiak Island Borough. 6 cases not previously reported were tested on the 1st. 3 of these cases are close contacts to previously reported cases. 3 of them are considered community transmission. 5 new cases not previously reported were tested on the 2nd. 2 of those cases are close contacts, and 3 are considered community transmission. 12 cases were tested on the 3rd. 8 of those cases are close contacts, and 4 cases are considered community transmission. This brings the case count associated with the Kodiak Island Borough to 434. 169 cases are now classified as active locally. 11 individuals have completed their isolation period and have been removed from the active list. The total number of local COVID-19 hospitalizations to date is 12. 2 patients are currently hospitalized. DHSS is urging anyone who receives a positive test to notify their own close contacts, and please do so as soon as possible. Light snow fell early this morning as the search continued for 2 Haines residents missing after a mudslide crashed through Beach Road residences. Haines Fire Chief Al Giddings says over 100 volunteers have reported to the public safety building to aid in the search and community recovery. 2 teams searched debris that washed onto miles of shoreline north of the slide. Juneau Mountain Rescue and 2 dog teams stand by at the slide site, waiting for the green light from geologists to begin the land search. Meanwhile, Haines Harbor and Coast Guard will be on the water.
They're going to start looking at the foot or the toe of the slide area, and they may have to pull some logs away to clear the beach area.
A Coast Guard boat and 4 crew are scheduled to arrive in Haines Friday morning. The state geologist will arrive by ferry. State officials say hackers have stolen personal information like birth dates and driver's license numbers of more than 100,000 Alaska voters, but they stress there were no effects on the results of last month's election. Republican Lieutenant Governor Kevin Meyer made the announcement at a news conference yesterday, where he called it an unfortunate discovery. The data was accessed through the state's online voter registration system. It's still not known exactly which records were stolen, but the state says the exposed data includes the names, dates of birth, driver's license numbers, addresses, party affiliations, and the last 4 digits of Social Security numbers. But at the news conference, Corey Mills, the state's chief assistant attorney general, said it doesn't go beyond that.
We looked, we didn't find any increase in identity theft. And in addition, the information here does not involve credit card information. It does not involve any economic information.
The state says hackers used assets inside and outside the United States. It's only identifying them now as outside actors. As required by law, election officials are notifying affected voters by mail. Officials say email addresses weren't included as part of Alaska's voter database, so that wasn't an option. All affected voters will have access to a year of free credit and ID monitoring from a service called Equifax. The flaw that allowed the hack has been fixed, and Alaskans' data is now secure, officials say. Hundreds wrote in to the Soldotna City Council to weigh in on a proposed mask requirement ahead of its December 2nd meeting, but the ordinance didn't make it to introduction. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
The Soldotna City Council decided at Wednesday's meeting not to hold a vote on a potential mask mandate, quashing the ordinance before it could reach a public hearing. But dozens of Soldotna residents weighed in on the virus anyway during the comment period for another resolution, which established a citywide COVID-19 education campaign under the city manager. It passed unanimously at the meeting. That resolution didn't sit well with many attendees.
We're overburdened with the whole indoctrination going both ways, with masks and without masks. The public's not retarded. We know that it's personal choice, and we know the risk.
That's Catherine Way. Like the hundreds of commenters who wrote in before the meeting, she said she fears government overreach from an education campaign or mask mandate. City Manager Stephanie Queen says information will come from the state, CDC, and local healthcare providers, but many said they don't trust the city to provide impartial information. Here's Soldotna resident John Lansing Jr.
This is just a very minor, minute thing that you guys are making a gigantic stink about. People walk around all day long, no masks, no problems. I hate to bring up the insensitive term of natural selection, but it's a real thing. You can't save everybody. If you are at high risk, stay home.
Some doubted that the hospital is full and that masks work. Three doctors from Central Peninsula Hospital called in to debunk that misinformation and talk about their experiences treating the virus. Chris Bodine is a hospitalist at CPH.
I just want to highlight, it's not just dying from COVID. It's also being hospitalized. It's being institutionalized. It's being a person that used to take care of themselves and can no longer.
Bodine says he's been working in the hospital throughout the pandemic and hasn't gotten sick because he's worn a mask and taken other precautions. He urged those listening to do the same. Internist Alexa Roden clarified that CPH is full and that when hospitals fill up, there are more deaths. She says she wanted the city to pass a mask mandate.
I worry that education at this point where we are at is just so insufficient to deal with what we are doing. And honestly, I have to say I'm pretty disappointed in what I saw today. I expected more of my local government.
Several listeners said they liked the idea of more education coming from city officials. Kenai Peninsula Borough Assemblyman Tyson Cox supports an education campaign.
Listening to the comments of other people is I do think education is probably a big deal and something we need to do, because there is a lot of misinformation out there. Like the person before said, there's a lot of information that people are getting from every source, but we can't just be on our own information. That's not the way this works.
At Cox's suggestion, the city council will send copies of its education plan to the borough, as well as the other city councils on the peninsula. As the five-hour meeting wrapped, Jordan Chilson and Pamela Parker said they were disappointed the ordinance on mask wearing couldn't go to public hearing. Chilson and Parker brought that ordinance forward and were the only council members to vote yes on introducing it. Other council members agreed that wearing masks is important, but said they worried such a conversation would lead to more division, or that they didn't see the point in enacting a mandate if none of the surrounding communities had mandates too. In his final comments, Chilson said that the time has passed to educate and ask nicely.
The Fed has made this clear that they do not want to take any strong mitigation measures because those need to be decided at a state level. States, in turn, say that those decisions need to be made at a local level, and that leaves us. no one's willing to stand up and make the hard decisions if we don't make them. They're simply not going to happen.
You can read the resolution that did pass regarding COVID-19 education on the city's website. For KDLL, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Reaction in Fairbanks was mixed to Thursday's announcement on the Trump administration's rescheduling of lease sales for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge's coastal plain. Responses by the Greater Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce and the Northern Alaska Environmental Center show the range of those perspectives. KUAC's Tim Ellis has this report.
Chamber President and CEO Marissa Scherer says the accelerated lease sale schedule is good news for Alaska because it could hasten development of the coastal plain, which would create jobs, boost state revenues, and invigorate the slumping economy.
An increase of production is good for state coffers.
Scherer says if the January 6 lease sales result in increased oil production, it also would help fill the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, which is now operating at only about half its capacity.
It's also good for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline system. It's been running at very low levels for a number of years, and that makes that piece of infrastructure that's critical to our state difficult to maintain.
But Emily Sullivan with Fairbanks-based Northern Alaska Environmental Center says the lease sales would only make life harder for the Gwich'in and Inupiaq people who live in and around the 1.5 million acre coastal plain.
Arctic people's lives are already endangered due to a rapidly warming climate.
Sullivan says indigenous peoples in the region already must deal with such climate change impacts as loss of sea ice and changing animal migration patterns, especially the porcupine caribou herd, a primary source of food for the Gwich'in.
Indigenous peoples are at the front lines of climate change and the most impacted. And the Arctic Refuge oil lease sales are projected to emit an additional 4 million tons of carbon dioxide. It's a terrible move for the climate. It's a terrible move for Arctic peoples.
Scherer says she's confident the Federal Bureau of Land Management's lease sale process and state regulators will ensure the well-being of the area's indigenous peoples and the environment.
The public is weighing in. They're sending their comments saying not to sell lease sales on the coastal plain and to protect parts of the coastal plain that are especially vulnerable.
Sullivan says BLM's surprise announcement also shows there was a political reason behind the decision.
So we see the Trump administration now rushing to get these lease sales completed before Trump leaves office and the Biden team transitions.
Scherer doubts that, and in any case, she sees a positive outcome to the lease sales.
I guess I'm not surprised that people would point to that, but again, this is a benefit for Alaskans.
Sullivan says it's now more important than ever for Alaskans to weigh in by December 17th to nominate lands that should be made available or not during the upcoming lease sale. Reporting from Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
The federal government has finalized an agreement with a Colorado mining company to permanently seal a former uranium mine in Southeast Alaska's Tongass National Forest. Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick has this report.
The Cold War-era Ross Adams mine hasn't produced uranium for nearly 50 years. But state regulators have been working to have the radioactive site on Prince of Wales Island cleaned up since the 1990s. This fall, the U.S. Forest Service finalized a plan for the Colorado-based Newmont Corporation to seal the former mine with concrete and haul away abandoned buildings. That's after state agencies and conservationists weighed in over the summer on the Forest Service's proposed agreement. The federal agency says it appreciated the input, then marked the draft plan final.
There were no changes necessary to the agreement.
Linda Riddle is the federal agency's coordinator for the project. She says the Forest Service isn't legally bound to coordinate with other agencies since the mine is completely within national forest land.
But I am giving them the opportunity to follow the project along and provide us comments if they have any. But it's more of an informal approach.
The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation has been aware of the contaminated site near Kendrick Bay since 1999. In comments to the Forest Service, it urged the agency to adopt the EPA's 5-year monitoring standard. But under the agreement signed between the former operators and federal government, the site will be monitored by the company for only 3 years. After that, all responsibility will shift to the Forest Service. In a statement, DEC says it's too early to tell how long the radioactive site will need to be monitored. That'll be clearer after the work has concluded. Still, conservationists have criticized the Forest Service's go-it-alone approach to cleaning up the site. Sally Slichting of the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council says state and federal environmental regulators are better equipped than the Forest Service to address the complexities of reclaiming a former uranium mine developed in the 1950s.
Certainly the state should have oversight on contaminated site cleanup work that happens here in the state of Alaska. And EPA has expertise in this area, and we would just feel more comfortable if those environmental agencies were having active oversight on this project.
The EPA indicated as recently as 2018 it should be more involved, but more recently it's deferred to the Forest Service's authority, but indicated it can still intervene if necessary. The Forest Service's Riddle says that will be the understanding between the two agencies going forward.
EPA doesn't normally get heavily involved in reviewing a document for a removal action. Now, if something comes to their attention that some concerns that we are not addressing, then they might get involved.
The cleanup plan will likely require a permit from Alaska's Department of Natural Resources to access state-owned tidelands. To date, no permits have been applied for. The timeline of the project isn't rushed. The cleanup plan is still in the pre-design phase. Actual work isn't expected until 2023 at the earliest. Impetus for this project comes from a separate mineral exploration effort about a mile away from the Prince of Wales site. Canada's UCOR has been investing in rare earths exploration on Boken Mountain. Cleaning up the radioactive waste will be key for the mining company to access Kendrick Bay, where material and equipment is hauled in and out by barge. The rare earth project is designed to mine for minerals used in high-tech products like smartphones and flat-screen televisions. The Trump administration has made domestic production of these resources a national security priority. But first, the toxic legacy of the former uranium mine, a national security priority from a different era, will need to be addressed. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. SeaShare sends more seafood to the nation's food banks as demand soars. More after this.
Did you know that eating wild and sustainable Alaska seafood can boost your immune system? Learn more about Alaska seafood's many proven nutritional benefits at wildalaskaseafood.com.
2 million pounds of seafood turns into 8 million meals at Feeding America food bank networks across the nation. That's how much the Seattle-based nonprofit SeaShare has donated to lower 48 states so far this year. Good protein is the toughest item for food banks to source. Alaskans also share in the seafood bounty.
I think we're at about 180,000 pounds, which is over 720,000 servings this year, which is more than we normally do.
Jim Harmon is SeaShare director. The donated seafood helps feed Alaskans in dozens of remote communities. The program began in 1994 with bycatch donations from boats fishing the Bering Sea, and it's expanded in the Gulf of Alaska to include 136 vessels, 12 shoreside processors, 34 catcher processors, and 3 motherships. SeaShare is the only group authorized to receive such donations. Today, bycatch makes up about 20% of the pack. The rest includes a wide array of products: smelt, halibut steaks, salmon burgers, breaded pollock portions, and more, all processed and donated by seafood companies.
The donations that the fishermen make and the processors make enable us to bring in other donations of freight, cold storage, packaging.
Harmon says the demand on food banks has soared due to the COVID pandemic.
The clients that go to food banks has doubled this year. I think it's 22% of Americans are accessing food banks, and that's unprecedented. That's an incredible need.
With many federal relief benefits set to expire at the end of December, demand will grow, and food banks are struggling to keep up. Harmon says every $1 donated to SeaShare equals 8 seafood servings at U.S. food banks. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
KMXT's Island Messenger, supported in part by the Kodiak Daily Mirror, your hometown newspaper since 1940. Now online at www.kodiakdailymirror.com.
Pardon me. Support the Mirror. Here's your Island Messenger for Friday. It is December 4th, the year 2020. The sun rose today at 9:34 a.m. It will set again at 4:25 this afternoon, giving us 6 hours and 51 minutes of daylight, a loss of 2 minutes and 26 seconds compared to yesterday. We have a high tide coming up here on the east side at 3:38 p.m. That will be a 9.1-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 10:35 p.m., a slight minus tide, minus 0.2 feet. Over on the west side, you have a high tide coming up at 4:14 this afternoon. That will be a 14.5-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 11:03 this evening of 0.08 feet. I think that's a zero-foot tide. 28 degrees right now in Kodiak out at the airport. We're looking for a slight chance of snow tonight with north winds to 15 miles per hour. 40% chance of snow tomorrow, mainly after 1 p.m., and even a little sun peeking out tomorrow. But tomorrow night, snow will begin after 10 p.m. The snow could be heavy at times, a low of about 30 on Saturday night. We're looking for that rain and snow, that snow to continue heavily on Saturday night and then turn to rain and snow on Sunday night. Heavy rain and snow on Saturday, on Sunday. So we have that coming. Mariners, here is your synopsis for the North Gulf Coast, including Kodiak Island waters and Cook Inlet. A front will enter the southern Gulf Saturday morning, while a complex 969 millibar low will move to 200 nautical miles south of Middleton Island Sunday morning. Your resulting weather, Marmot Island to Sitkanak, we have a gale warning on Saturday. For tonight, northeast wind to 20 knots and seas to 9 feet with freezing spray. But for tomorrow, we're looking for east winds to 35 knots tomorrow afternoon, going to 45 knots tomorrow night, seas to 17 feet. And on Sunday, southeast winds to 35 knots on the east side offshore, seas to 27 feet. Over in the Shelikof, small craft advisory through Saturday. For tonight, we have northeast wind to 25 knots, seas to 9 feet in the Shelikof with freezing spray. For tomorrow night, look for northeast winds to 45 knots and seas to 14 feet. And for Sunday in the Shelikof, northeast 45, seas to 17. If you haven't applied for the utility relief program and you are a water and sewer customer of the city, whether you live inside the city limits or not, you probably should, because anyone who has any financial impact from COVID-19 and who is a water and sewer customer is eligible. You can find the application at the City of Alaska website. And remember, the Kiwanis tree sales are going on until December 13th, so you have about 9 more days to get your tree. It's happening Friday, Saturdays, and Sundays, so I guess less than that. Fridays between 4 p.m. and 7 p.m., Saturdays between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m., and Sundays between noon and 4 p.m., and that's at the Worldwide Movers office.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.